Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org. Welcome to a special Capital Conversations edition of the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleforum conference call as today, May 20th, 2020, we get an update on current affairs at the U.S. Department of Treasury. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast and will likely be transcribed. We're very pleased to welcome a familiar face, or a familiar voice, I should say, to Teleforum, Brent J. McIntosh. He's the Undersecretary of International Affairs at the U.S. Department of Treasury. He's going to talk to us about the priorities of the office, how he's doing there, how the office is doing before, during, and after COVID-19. We're going to do this sort of in an interview style, but as always, we'll be getting to questions from the audience, so please be thinking of those for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Brent McIntosh, welcome to the program. It's great to have you with us.
Dean, I'm delighted to be here today with you, and thanks for having me.
Of course. Happy to do it. I mentioned you're a familiar voice to many in the Federalist Society, but perhaps not everybody. So I was hoping that maybe for those on the line who don't already know you, you could just give us a little bit of background about yourself, professional career, and then maybe segue into your current role.
Sure. Thanks, Dean. Well, I'm a kid from the state of Michigan, a proud Michigander, and I must say it's been troubling to see the news today on the flooding on the Tittabawassee River out there, and our hearts all go out to the folks who live in that area, including many friends of mine. Here at Treasury, I serve in the role of Undersecretary for International Affairs, which is one of the three undersecretariats. It is, for international purposes, the U.S.'s Deputy Finance Minister. So for purposes of interacting with our international counterparts, whether bilaterally or through multilateral institutions like the G7 and the G20, the IMF and World Bank, the Financial Stability Board, it's the Deputy Finance Minister role, charged with representing the United States internationally in economic and financial matters. This is a job I took in the middle of last year when my predecessor, David Malpass, became the president of the World Bank. At the time he took that job, I was serving as general counsel of the Treasury, a job I did for about 2 years, one that I had become interested in when I was serving in the White House in 2006 to 2009, because my great friend Bob Hoyt had gone from being in the White House counsel's office, where we sat next door to each other, to being the general counsel of the Treasury Department. I watched him do that job during the 2008-2009 financial crisis and respond to that crisis. And I thought it was Treasury would be a very interesting and rewarding place to serve the American people. And so I did that for a couple of years, having come before that from practicing law at Sullivan and Cromwell. And before that, I was a law clerk to the great Judge Larry Silberman and the great Judge Dennis Jacobs. So that's my legal background and how I got to where I am and what I'm doing now.
Very interesting. You know, I was honored to visit you in your office when you were the general counsel, and it was an exquisite office in the Treasury building. I think you had told me it was Samuel Chase's former office, and at one time the secretary's office, and Lincoln himself had come over there to chat with Samuel Chase, or to at least hold forth a little bit. In moving to become undersecretary, did you have to give that office up? That's a key question, Brent.
I did have to give that office up, Dean. It was a sacrifice, but the move was not a particularly difficult one, because I moved from Secretary Chase's office to the office that was the Secretary's office following Secretary Chase, which has the distinction of having briefly also been the office of the President of the United States after President Lincoln's assassination. President Johnson sat in this office for about 6 weeks. While Mary Todd Lincoln was still in the White House. So it is itself a historic office and has a beautiful view of the East Wing of the White House. So I'm very fortunate to have moved from one great office to another great office.
Well, having been there, it's like a museum in your offices. So at least you've got that going for you. I'm curious, you know, how does your workload now as undersecretary compare to general counsel and compare generally to private practice? A lot of our members are in private practice. I'm just curious how you're finding that.
It's a great question. I would say the workload right now is not determined by which seat I'm in, but by world events. And so we've been joking around here since about mid-February that every day is Wednesday, and that includes Saturdays and Sundays. So the workload right now is intense because of the need to respond to the virus. I would say that the workload at Treasury, the pace is rapid. In any of these government positions in which there's really important work to be done. So the pace is rapid, and it certainly is not, it's not like you step into the government from private practice of law, and it's a relaxing and slow pace. In fact, the pace is dramatic and fast, and the burdens are very substantial, and they don't wait for 9 a.m., they pop up on nights and early mornings and in the middle of the night and on weekends. So it's been particularly intense, and it's only redoubled since the outbreak.
Well, I want to get to some more specifics on the coronavirus in a moment, but before we go there, can you just give me a general sense of, you know, I've not been in Washington probably for 10 weeks or so, because at the Federal Society, we're working from home, still very busy. And I talk to a lot of people who are working from home who say they're as busy as ever or even busier in some ways. It's a different style of work. But I think you're in the office every day. What's it like being in Washington? What's it like in your office? How are things functioning?
It's eerily quiet in downtown Washington for those who haven't been here since the pandemic and since the stay-at-home orders went into place. I continue to come into the office along with a handful of my colleagues in a building that holds a couple thousand people normally, and you find that there are a few of us who are here every day. There's essentially no commute to get here. The feeling inside the building is quite different in terms of temperature checks coming in, masks seated around the building strategically along with hand sanitizer, many of the chairs removed in meeting rooms so that no one can sit near anyone else. So there definitely is a very different feel to it. We continue to come to work, a handful of us, because we're meeting regularly with the secretary and also dealing with some highly sensitive information, including classified information. So it's most easy to do in the office. For me, it's also convenient to continue coming to work because I lose my office at home every morning at 8:30 to a seventh grader tele-learning. So, but it's a very strange feel. I've occasionally gone out onto the National Mall for a run in an attempt to break up the day. And out on the mall, it does feel a bit. It's very quiet, very few people. It almost seems like a left behind scenario where only the joggers were left behind. It's a strange feeling, no question.
That's an interesting description, but I can imagine it. So in addition to being Undersecretary for International Affairs, you're tasked with leading Treasury's coronavirus subtask force. So digging down a little bit on that, what does that mean? What does that entail? And as you answer that, if you could talk about the CARES Act and the details of that and getting that squared away.
Sure. I mean, it's been a very interesting transition from completely focused on international affairs to adding in obligations to work on the CARES Act programs. If you just step back and look at how quickly that transformation happened, in early February, I and some of my colleagues were in Tokyo and Singapore dealing with what you might consider typical international affairs business, discussing the U.S.-Japan economic relationship. And in Singapore, we had a meeting regarding cryptocurrencies, a series of meetings regarding cryptocurrencies. A couple of weeks later, we were all in Riyadh for the G20 finance ministers meeting. And at that point, only the Chinese were unable to travel to Riyadh for that meeting. A week after that, I hosted the G7 finance minister deputies in Baltimore for a meeting. And for that meeting, the Italians couldn't come. And by a week later, all the international travel was being canceled. And by a week after that, we were moving into mandatory work from home. So the shift has been dramatic, going from being on the road probably 35-40% of my time to being the only international affairs undersecretary who doesn't go anywhere international anymore. But there have been additional work obligations to more than fill the void there in the CARES Act programs. When the CARES Act went from being an idea that had been conceived as a way of providing fiscal support to the economy to being passed in about 10 days, which is a remarkable, a truly stunning pace for a piece of legislation that large, a $2 trillion piece of legislation. And when it was passed, there were any number of programs that needed to be operational at the Treasury Department. And it's not like we have off-the-shelf units that are designed to do things like small business lending or getting money out to 130 million American taxpayers or providing support to employees of airlines. And so we had to stand up immediately groups within the Treasury Department, which we put together using people from across Treasury, as well as detailees from a variety of other agencies who raised their hand and said, I'm not busy right now on my day job, so can I help out with this? And it has been extremely heartening to watch people raise their hand and volunteer to work on these programs. And the speed with which they have been stood up and operationalized and gotten money out to Americans who need it has been really gratifying and inspiring. When you look at, for example, the small business lending program, which we call PPP, the Small Business Administration put out 14 years worth of loans in 14 days. And when you look at the second tranche of loans that they put out there, the second tranche of payments, that was the average payment size there was $80,000. So you're talking about truly small businesses benefiting from this. Similarly, when you look at the payments to American taxpayers, 130 million American taxpayers, $218 billion in less than 5 weeks, a truly remarkable achievement in terms of the agility of the federal government to get those funds out. For my own part, I've been working very intensely on the work to get funds to employees of air carriers. The air carriers have obviously suffered a great deal, and their employees have suffered a great deal because of the dramatic drawdown in travel, the cliff's edge effect that they've seen through no fault of their own. And so we've been working along hand in hand with the Department of Transportation to get out to them support for airline workers who otherwise presumably would be furloughed. We've already sent out over $25 billion or committed over $25 billion to over 300 applicants for that program and are continuing to work through what remaining applications we have, as well as working on a lending program that will also benefit air carriers. And all of these are being done so that we can reopen the economy and revive the economy as quickly as possible once it is safe to do so, consistent with health outcomes, because we want to preserve the existing economic and financial arrangements so they don't need to be reconstructed when we reopen the economy, so that we can, as much as possible, turn the economy back on. And keeping people in employment arrangements is one key aspect of that. And so we've been working very hard on those programs. That's a long answer. I apologize. But
That's all very interesting. You mentioned, of course, the $2 trillion in the CARES Act and how quickly that got done. It is astounding to me that you can get 14 years worth of loans out in 14 days. I'm wondering, with regard to the CARES Act in particular, how much flexibility is built into that? How much, at your level, I mean, how much are you able to say this small business is not the same as this business, or this industry is not quite as hard hit as this industry, this part of retail or something like that. So you can direct the funds where you might think they're most needed.
You know, in a situation like this, that is, although there are aspects of that, and it varies across programs, there are aspects of that. The truth is, because this is unlike 2008, 2009, where the distress was primarily concentrated in certain sectors, this is a pandemic that has caused harm broadly across the real economy. And so the priority right now is getting money out because businesses across sectors have been hit dramatically. Now, it's true that there are some of the programs that focus on particularly disrupted industries. So, for example, the air carrier industry is one where there's just a huge need because of the tremendous drop-off in air travel. But more than that, it really is key to get money out, especially to small and medium-sized enterprises that may not have access to market financing in the same way that a larger enterprise might, just to preserve those employment relationships. And it's been less about being fine-grained and choosing who gets the money than in letting people identify that they are in need, they need the money to pay their employees, and getting the money out as quickly as possible for purposes of ensuring that those employment relationships are preserved.
Yeah, that seems to be a key. So you mentioned a lot about getting the money out and making sure it's going to the right places. Have there been other major challenges, anything that you were surprised by in this process?
Well, I would say that not just for us, but around the world, challenges abound. This is a historic challenge for all of us, and I speak to my foreign counterparts regularly. I've spoken to counterparts from over 50 countries since the outbreak, and it is the number and variety of challenges has been truly astounding. Both the unprecedented scale and pace of the economic harm, the fact that we're dealing not just with an economic situation, but with a public health situation, the way that we're trying to do so and deal with it in a world in which all of our usual work routines have been disrupted, the fact that we're doing so in a situation where there's no real off the shelf mechanism to resolve these issues. But I will say I've been really heartened and inspired by the response inside the United States, outside the United States, among my colleagues in the federal government, in state and local governments. The dedication that people have shown, the speed with which they've acted, the creativity and resiliency and innovation they've shown, the real sense of camaraderie and collaboration you see. When you look at the video of people applauding healthcare workers who are leaving for work or leaving work, you see that sort of spirit throughout the reaction here. It's not just the people applauding. You see it everywhere. You see the people on my team raising their hands saying, it doesn't fall within my responsibilities, but I'm happy to help out on this air carrier support program. How can I help? And taking on duties that fall. You know, some of these people have advanced degrees in economics, and they're working on ensuring that the applications get processed in a timely fashion and we can get the money out the door. That's not their day job. That's not what was in their job description when they were hired. But these folks have raised their hand and have been willing to help out. And so for every challenge, I think we've seen a truly inspiring response. And that to me has been what keeps us coming to work on every single Wednesday.
That is really heartening, and I do. I hear you talking about Wednesday hump day. You never quite get over the hump, it sounds like. I do want to dig down into the international response in a minute, but before we go there, I wonder if you've got any insights into how Congress got this done? I mean, it's interesting to me that major pieces of legislation are just so difficult to pass. I'm thinking back to the 1970s and environmental legislation and telecommunications stuff that just doesn't it passes, but it never gets updated. It rarely gets reauthorized. We had 9/11, and we get the Patriot Act. It seems in times of crisis, Congress is willing to and able to come together and undertake major legislation. Is that what accounts for this here? And this is outside of your area of expertise, but are there any lessons there or any insights there?
Yeah, I don't pretend to be a legislative affairs expert, but I'll say that having watched the negotiation of the CARES Act, which was passed on a uniform bipartisan basis, and having watched the negotiations of the act with the White House and Secretary Mnuchin, Republicans and Democrats in the Senate and in the House, and watching the good faith work that they did to come to an agreement that could pass in the way it did, does suggest that the Congress is able to get important work done on a bipartisan basis in an emergency, and they really did do that here. For example, we've talked a great deal with Senator Warner, who's done just an immense amount of hard work on this, and it's been gratifying to be able to work with him on some of these programs. And that sort of bipartisanship is a welcome sight in light of the challenges we're facing.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it makes me wonder if the inverse implication isn't equally true. That is, if Congress is unable to come together on something, whatever policy it is, it's not truly urgent. It's not absolutely necessary. But that's not a question. That's just a comment of my own. Before we go into the international stuff, I do have one more question I want to ask. But let me open the floor to questions first so people can begin to queue up. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, Brent McIntosh, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Again, I want to turn to the international stuff briefly, but before that, you mentioned the federal and state sort of levels of cooperation and how heartening that is. I wonder if you want to say a little bit more about not just the cooperation, but the coordination and how that's working. Does that impact your work? Is it really necessary in your work at Treasury to have the cooperation of governors or state AGs or state legislators or what's that like?
Yeah, I think the primary place where the coordination with the states is crucial is on the reopening work, which has been led by the White House. Thinking through the three-phase plan that they've put out and working with states to ensure that they have sufficient testing and are able to reopen in a responsible way. So, and I think, frankly, down the line, inevitably, when we attempt to teach federalism to high school students, how responsibility and authority resides as between the federal government and the states, this is a good example that will be used to explain that. From our perspective, there is a great deal of COVID-related need in the states. And so we have funds to provide to the states for those response purposes. And some of my colleagues have been working intensely on getting that money out to the states so that they can use those on response. I would say that a number of the states are doing a really terrific job, and it's been a great collaboration with them over the time of the pandemic.
The news media, and if you're not able to answer this question, it's fine. The news media has made a fair amount of hay over the way different states have handled the closing down at the first instance, and the way they've responded, and consequently, I suppose the effects felt within a state. Some states, seem to have lower rates of infection, lower fatality rates, and so I suppose the needs within state might differ, but it might be based on their initial responses. Do you hear, or are you just getting a sense of those sorts of dynamics between the states?
That doesn't really touch the real I do, Dean, but I will say I don't think we should be surprised that states take different tacks here, because they have states have different levels of density, they have different levels of infection, they have different health systems, and so I think we would expect that there'd be some amount of variation among the states, and that's characteristic of our federalist system.
So I began to hear you, I think, suggest that my last question wasn't really relevant to your work. So let's move on. We do have three questions pending. Before we get to those questions, I want to give you a chance to talk more about your international work and the worldwide cooperation, worldwide coordination. What does all of that look like? And if you can talk about some of the work that's underway in various multilateral fora, whether that's the G7, the G20, and then maybe a little bit about opening back up globally and what that might look like, global supply chains with different countries at sort of different stages in the COVID curve.
Yeah, well, I actually think your being disconnected may have been staged to set up this question, because the one thing I'll say is, as we have reconstituted our normal bilateral and multilateral engagements around the world, through telephonic and video conference means, it turns out that it doesn't matter how important the person on the other end is, there is inevitably a problem with the mute button or being disconnected. And this includes when you're dealing with foreign ministers and central bank governors, there's inevitably some sort of comical mute issue. The vision of seamless international communications that you see when you watch TV and movies is simply not the case. But I will say the international community has done a remarkable job of reconstituting what are normally in-person engagements through virtual means. So the World Bank and the IMF held its meetings last month virtually. The G7 and the G20, we in the United States are currently the G7 presidency this year, and the Saudis are the G20 presidency, have, if anything, quickened the pace of meetings and calls, even though we are no longer actually meeting in person. And so when you look at the pace of those, the Secretary Mnuchin, for example, yesterday held a G7 finance minister's call in the morning at the same time that Randy Quarles from the Fed was hosting a Financial Stability Board meeting virtually. So you have a real up-tempo pace for these interactions, and it's essential that we do so, because the international community has very much stepped up, and I think in a way that hasn't drawn the notice that it needs. For example, if you look at the poorest countries, which have the poorest 70 countries in the world, which have immense debt service obligations, the IMF and the World Bank suggested at some point a couple months ago that it would be a good idea to suspend debt service payments for those countries for the rest of the year. And so we worked intensely with the G7 and then with the G20 to get the entire body of creditor countries on board with suspending debt service payments so that those poor countries could spend the money that would be paid to official bilateral creditors and instead could use that money for their health response if they so choose. And a number of countries have taken us up on that offer and have asked for debt service suspension. Similarly, the IMF and the World Bank have both been working on expanding their response. The World Bank has over 100 different countries requesting funds to respond to COVID-19. The IMF has facilities in place to aid countries that need immediate financing on a rapid basis so as to deal with the outbreak. And that collaboration has all happened through virtual conversations among the finance ministers and central bank governors, and then among the leaders, in a way that if you had said 3 months ago we were going to achieve all this virtually, it would be very difficult to imagine be possible. And yet there's been real agility in moving to take what are truly dramatic steps internationally in a way while doing so telephonically or by video conference.
Very interesting. I mean, it's heartening to hear you refer to agility repeatedly and nimbleness. That's very encouraging. We do have three questioners on the line right now. Let's turn to our first caller.
Hello, my name is Ken Cottup, and I live in Birmingham, Michigan, and grew up in Port Huron, Michigan, so I haven't gotten very far. So congratulations to you. My question is this. I was reading someplace that the use of by using the U.S. banking and dollar system as a way to punish, if you will, people who don't follow what we believe to be the right thing, such as the Russian oligarchs, and there's a whole string of people, is going to lead to the use or the development of an alternative world currency to the U.S. dollar. And what is going to be, how true is that? And if that were to happen, how would that affect this enormous borrowing that we seem to be having to do in order to assuage the problems of the current pandemic?
Thanks for that question. I think the question deals with the fact that there are some who would like to avoid U.S. sanctions, which are executed generally through the fact that most financial transactions touch the U.S. system because of the dollarization of many international transactions, and whether our use of sanctions threatens that. You do hear people occasionally say that. We've seen no evidence that, in fact, the dollarization of a large part of the economy is imperiled by the use of sanctions. We do try to use sanctions in a tailored and sophisticated way to target primarily those who are engaged in bad acts, while also finding ways to ensure that, for example, the populations that would be affected by them are nonetheless able to receive humanitarian goods. So we work hard here at Treasury and across the federal government to tailor sanctions in a way that have maximum effectiveness with a minimum of harm to humanitarian aspects. And we do not see that as imperiling the role of the dollar in the world system.
Head in a new direction, area code 415. Go right ahead, caller.
Sorry, Dean. This is Joanne Madero. I have a question, and we're more generally get some observations on China and our, I'll call it capital markets relationships there. Last night, the Senate passed on unanimous consent a bill that would over time require the delisting of Chinese companies whose accounting standards are deficient. So just curious as to the Treasury's views on the China relationship.
Thanks. It's a great question. I think there's no secret that there have been some in the administration, including the president, who have expressed disappointment with China's reaction to the coronavirus situation, and that the White House has been taking a number of actions in response to that. And I'm sure with the fullness of time, all of the immediate actions that countries took after the outbreak will be examined and accounted for. My current priority right now is forward-looking response measures. I know that the SEC and others, as well as many people in Congress, are looking at the question of capital markets issues around companies that may be using different accounting standards and different amounts of transparency. I don't want to second guess or try to predict, rather, where those results will end up. I do think that they are taking a very hard look at that, and I would expect that that they will make an informed set of decisions about that. It's not something that falls within my day-to-day obligations, but I do know that there is a hard look being taken at those matters, in particular regarding the capital markets.
Let's check in with another caller. Area code 571. Go right ahead, caller.
Yes. Hi. This is Steve Dewey. Brent, thanks for taking the time. Discussion's been very informative. Question I have, I'm curious about the involvement, to what extent FSOC has been involved in the over the last couple months with the pandemic. I haven't really heard much at all about FSOC. And also, I'm curious to what extent you have any interactions or collaboration with other foreign central banks, or is that pretty much left to the Federal Reserve?
Yeah, let me take those in turn. FSOC, for those who are not familiar with the acronym, is the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which was a creation of the Dodd-Frank Act. It was, during the prior administration, the body of chaired by the Treasury Secretary with the financial and capital markets regulators sitting around the table, as well as certain state bodies as well. It was the organization that during the prior administration was in charge of designating financial institutions as systemically important. The FSOC more recently has been a very useful forum for the secretary and the various heads of the financial and regulatory agencies to get together to talk about potential financial stability concerns and to ensure that they have a common understanding of those concerns, and that one who may have particular insight into a particular concern can share it with the others, and they can talk it through in a robust basis. The FSOC has been meeting and discussing these issues. They had a meeting, it was either a week ago or 2 weeks ago, I think it was a week ago, on this, where they discussed the primary agenda item was about financial stability concerns regarding COVID-19 and how they were being addressed by the various regulators, and they went around and discussed that. So there's no question the FSOC has been a useful forum for discussion of these sorts of issues and continues to play that role during the COVID-19 outbreak. With regard to the central banks, the central banks tend to talk to one another, but in multilateral fora such as the G7 and the G20, generally, the finance ministers and central banks meet together, and then sometimes they have breakout sessions where we talk about our finance ministry matters and they talk about their central bank matters. But generally, the meetings are done together, so there is a good deal of discussion so that the fiscal and monetary sides of the house can understand each other and what they're seeing in terms of the economy more broadly. So there is some amount of interaction with foreign central banks, but the primary relationship there is with the Federal Reserve.
Great.
Thank you, caller. I wanted to, while we're waiting to see if others ring in, give you a chance, Brent, to say more about your broader, we talked about China briefly, but your broader international affairs priorities and how those might be affected in the corona era?
Yeah, a great question, Dean. We had laid out a series of priorities when I became Undersecretary for International Affairs at Treasury. And what's been interesting is how those priorities have generally not fallen away. They've changed a bit in terms of their emphasis. Obviously, the number one emphasis anywhere has to be right now COVID-19 response. But if you look at the set of priorities, and I'll mention a few of them we had laid out, they actually have, if anything, they may have shifted in emphasis toward COVID-19 and become even more pressing, but they haven't fallen away. So, for example, one of our key priorities was dealing with emphasizing the need for responsible market-based economic and financial and trade practices, and thoughtful and vigilant work to ensure that non-market-based practices that some countries practice don't compromise U.S. interests. And that has been all the more important in light of the COVID-19 outbreak and seeing the dynamic aspects of that on the global economy, and knowing that we need to be ever more vigilant to ensure that we are continuing to support responsible market-based practices. Another one of our priorities has been ensuring that we are demonstrating U.S. and exercising U.S. leadership in global economic affairs. That has become all the more important here. So, for example, when the World Bank and the IMF proposed the debt service suspension initiative, we worked very hard in the United States, both here and at the White House and at the National Economic Council, to build consensus for that. And there was, I would say that initially there was some skepticism in some parts of the world, and yet ultimately the entire G20 and the entire Paris Club signed on to that, which was, I think, a remarkable statement about international collaboration. Another of our priorities here was ensuring debt transparency and sustainability for sovereigns around the world. And that has become dramatically more important and pressing and really to the forefront of our work as countries take on increased debt and borrow to deal with the COVID-19 crisis. And then another of our priorities has been CFIUS reform, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which was the subject for the first time in many decades of thoroughgoing reform only a year and a half ago. And ensuring that that reform is effective has taken on even greater overtones in this situation, where we need to ensure that we use strict, rigorous scrutiny of foreign investment in the United States to ensure that benign foreign investment can continue to flow into the United States. So flips two sides of the same coin. We need to be rigorous in our scrutiny of investment coming into the United States. And in doing so, we empower investors to invest in the United States, which is essential. Those capital flows, cross-border capital flows, are essential to global prosperity. So these are all priorities that were pre-existed the COVID crisis, and they have only become all the more important as we address the COVID crisis. And that's why we find ourselves dealing not just with the standalone COVID issues, but continuing to execute on our pre-existing priorities while we're handling the COVID-specific programs.
Very good. We do have one more question in the audience, but Brent, since you mentioned CFIUS, I've got a bit, and this might not be a question or a comment, I'm not sure, or even you can respond to it, but I'm a big fan of that, the idea that there's a sort of collaborative group within the government, high-ranking, monitoring foreign investment in the United States with U.S. national security in mind, but also with a robust economy, international marketplace in mind. One thing that's concerned me is whether or not there's anything like that for enforcement, especially independent agency enforcement. And this goes to the unitary executive, well beyond your current role. But if you'd like to express a thought, I'd be interested. I see some independent agencies enforcing against big tech companies in ways that, and these are tech companies that are providing, I think, some national security services to the United States. And, you know, if you're enforcing against Boeing or a shipbuilder or something like that, a defense contractor, it's pretty easy to see the national security implications. But I'm wondering, when an independent agency enforces against somebody that's in the national security realm, a private actor, is there any process within the federal government to consider that outside that one independent agency?
Yeah, it's a great question, Dean. I don't think there's no formalized process for that. I will say that I've seen I don't want to talk about any specific case, but I've definitely seen situations where an independent agency has potential action that it may want to take, but does want to be informed by the national security apparatus of the potential national security consequences of that. And so while there's no formal setup that I'm aware of to vindicate those interests, I know that on a more one-off basis, there certainly are instances where the national security apparatus will inform an agency of potential concerns about potential consequences to national security.
Good, good. Good to know that's available. I mentioned we do have another question, so let's check in with another audience member. Go right ahead, caller.
Hi, Dean and Brent. This is Leo Connor. Thank you so much. And Dean, your question, and Brent, your answer sort of preempted my question, so I'll get a little more particular about it. Many have long lamented that so many U.S. manufacturing jobs have gone overseas, and especially now we know that life-saving pharmaceuticals are now manufactured almost exclusively in China. Less noticed, but also coming to light of late, and this is something that you brought up, Dean, CFIUS, is that so much U.S. property is now owned by the Communist Party of China or its delegates, including essential components of our food chain. I think that, you know, including Smithfield, for example, I think that I've read that the Communist Party of China or its delegates own 25% of America's meat production. So is Treasury, I'm wondering, number one, how does that happen? And number two, is Treasury working on any legislative proposals or on any stricter enforcement to protect Americans from the harmful influence of foreign investment in U.S. assets?
Thanks, Leah. Nice to hear from you. One of the great things that the CFIUS reform legislation does is it allows us to, you mentioned real estate, it allows us to look at sensitive real estate as a potential CFIUS issue. And so CFIUS has put out extensive regulations regarding acquisitions of some types of real estate with proximity to some facilities. On the other hand, it is essential that we continue to have an open investment environment, and we do want to ensure that we are rigorous in ensuring that the CFIUS process focuses on national security concerns. And so we enforce that in our own review of transactions, and it's one of the things we routinely discuss with our foreign partners to ensure that they are not using CFIUS-type regimes for protectionist policies, but instead to focus only on national security concerns. So there are very hard questions at the margins here, and we take them very seriously. And I know that there have been various proposals on the Hill, and we look at each of them as they come up, and we'll work with the White House to ascertain an administration position on them. But we are being very vigilant. A set of investments that now fall within the jurisdiction of CFIUS that prior to last year did not fall within that jurisdiction. Another one I would add that I think is a crucial change in the way CFIUS works is that we now have the ability to look at transactions that touch sensitive personal data. No one would have thought 40 years ago when the CFIUS legislation was passed that we would need to be looking at transactions that touch the data of millions of Americans, but that's now a crucial aspect of protecting national security. You can have all sorts of sensitive personal data in there, including those of military personnel, and ensuring the protection of that data and that it doesn't fall into the hands of those who would do us harm is an essential expansion of the CFIUS jurisdiction, and one that we're putting into operation even now.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Brent. And so I gather then that investments that give a foreign entity or a foreign country control over a big part of our food chain is now considered part of national security?
So we don't do broad sweeping statements about categories of transactions. We evaluate every transaction on a deal-by-deal basis as is required by statute. And if there were a transaction that resulted in risk, an unmitigable risk arising to the national security based on a particular transaction, it would fall within the jurisdiction of CFIUS.
And you said that was last reformed last year?
It's the FIRMA legislation, which was passed, it was actually passed, I believe, a little more than a year and a half ago, but it's been coming into operation as the statutory effective dates come into place.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lee.
Let me ask you my final question, Brent, and that is about the expansion and contraction of government powers. Should we be concerned about the expansion of government powers in what amounts to an emergency situation? And how do we best make sure that government powers go back to the pre-emergency norm, if you will? And I'd ask that question not just about your work at Treasury, but just government generally, just as somebody who's been involved with the government for some time.
Yeah, that's a tough question of political theory, Dean, and one I think we've all seen play out in a variety of different situations over time. I can say that with regard to this pandemic, there's no question that there's been an expansion of certain government powers and clearly, there have been situations in which we have demanded of private companies that take government money that they take certain actions, whether it be based on the legislation that they can't engage in buybacks or dividends, or they need to keep a certain percentage of their employees on payroll or things like that. And those are the sorts of powers that you would not want the government to be exercising, wielding in a normal situation. But in this situation, you can understand why when the government is providing a great deal of funding in an emergency situation, those would be the conditions attached to it. I think it's essential, and I think Congress has recognized in this legislation, that those powers be temporary, that they be timely and temporary and targeted. And so that's been very much our mantra in seeking legislation and in exercising the powers, that we don't want this power forever. We want it to go away on a statutory date when it's no longer needed. And we only want to wield it so long as it's essential for keeping the economy moving toward a vigorous and robust reopening. And not one day later than that. I can tell you, as much as it has been an experience and an honor to be able to work on these air carrier support programs, neither I nor the carriers nor the employees of the carriers want the federal government to have to be handling this and supporting the air carriers one day longer than is necessary to ensure that we have a functioning air carrier industry upon a time when people start flying again.
Well, that's very good. Thank you for that. We've got a couple minutes left, so I want to give you an opportunity, Undersecretary, to express any final thoughts or wrap up before we adjourn.
Well, thanks, Dean. It's been I've really enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed the chance to engage with the questions. I will say one of the things that has been, I mentioned this earlier, but just to emphasize it, it really has been the case that U.S. leadership in response to this pandemic, U.S. leadership in international bodies, and U.S. leadership by example, and leadership we have shown in terms of formulating our economic response as a government, but also the leadership that the private sector in the United States has shown, the ingenuity and creativity and dedication to finding solutions. It has been really inspiring, and has been, it's really been the sort of thing where you really can't overstate how important U.S. leadership has been, both the leadership of the U.S. government and the leadership of U.S. private sector, because it has been, and I think will continue to be, crucial to the global recovery. Everything from the work of the Fed to inject liquidity into the system and provide dollar liquidity and ensure credit markets continue to operate. And it's very hard to say how broadly that affected the world. I mean, it truly was essential to the functioning of the global economy, down to the point of U.S. companies and their work on vaccines and therapeutics. There's no question that the dynamism of the American economy has taken a hit because of this. On the other hand, that dynamism is crucial to our response, not just as a country, but globally. And so when I look at it, I'm inspired to work with these folks, and I'm looking forward to a robust and vigorous recovery as soon as we can get the economy rolling again.
Well, this has been terrific, Brent. Thank you so much for being with us today. More importantly, thank you for serving as Undersecretary for International Affairs. It gives me personally comfort to know that you were there. So I want to thank you on a personal level, but also on behalf of the Federalist Society. Thank you for being with us today. I want to thank the audience as well for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions, and remind the audience to check the Federal Society's website and your emails for notices of upcoming telephone conference calls. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.